Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio, the first day of December. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very, very happy to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War. You, I'm sure, see his columns all over the place, including the Kenosha News on a regular basis. Perhaps some of you also hear his periodic visits to WUWM, our public radio station to the north. And we are always happy when we can have Professor Sear here once a month to offer his analysis of events here and around the world. And I can't think of a more important moment to have Professor Sear here, because, of course, a lot of really, really important things have happened in recent weeks, most of them disturbing and unsettling. Events in Paris, events in Chicago, and other really pressing matters that we want to talk about. So, Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, especially after that particularly gracious introduction. The least I could do is accept your invitation and show up. Thank you,
well,
Professor.
Glad you can be here. Glad you can be here. I wonder, first of all, what your own personal reaction was to the horrific event in Paris recently. What sorts of things did it sort of bring to mind? I guess I'm asking on a fairly personal and kind of visceral level, how you took in those events.
I think your reaction is not only appropriate, but it's also important. It's important that we not take these events, not start to assume they're routine, and not take these events as an acceptable part of daily life. The Paris attacks, to me, were one of the latest in a continuing series of terrorist attacks. Because it was Paris, the city of light, not just from the biased perspective of French people, it gets a lot of publicity. These kinds of, and I don't minimize the horrific nature of the attacks, in other parts of the world, things like this do not get so much attention. I think because it received so much attention and because it was a major military ally as well as industrial and commercial power, it really has had a relatively large impact on our alliance relations and on opinion, especially in Europe. But things like this go on an unfortunately pretty routine basis in Africa, other parts of the world, Central Asia, and do not get so much attention. I think it's important to keep that in mind. Hmm. I'm not in any way, again, minimizing the importance of what happened in this particular event. It's interesting to me that you and others have reacted as strongly as you have.
Right.
I think that's important.
It was intriguing, for instance, on a social media site like Facebook. There were all kinds of posts made about it, and there, at the click of a button, one could transform one's own profile photo to reflect that kind of tricolor scheme of the French flag.
Yes, indeed.
A gesture of solidarity, which all kinds of people did. In fact, the vast majority of my own Facebook friends did that, as did I. And at some point, somebody went on there and said, when is Facebook going to have the colors of the flag of Mali, so that we can click our profile pictures and reflect the tragedy which just occurred there or in other parts of the world? Why is it that we suddenly have this great outpouring of solidarity and concern just because it happened in a place like Paris? Mm-hmm. It was an interesting moment. I mean, I had, in a sense, myself at least, sort of plead guilty to, in a sense, perhaps overreacting to this event, or maybe it's more correct to say underreacting to similar events when they play out in other parts of the world, where it doesn't feel like, in a sense, it has happened to a neighbor.
You brought up social media. In a sense, it provides a kind of equalizing effect, which I don't believe is fully understood, even though there's lots of commentary of all kinds constantly in the 24/7 news cycle on the importance of social media. I don't want to pry, but since you brought it up, if I may ask, how many Facebook friends do you have, sir?
I have more than 1,000, actually. There,
uh-huh.
But
boy, that's really impressive. Thank you for sharing that. there are relatively few people that you actually know as friends, I'd assume.
Right. Yeah. Right? I think that word gets used very loosely, and I think some people choose to use
sure
Facebook.
Does. Yeah. Sure does.
Some people use Facebook in a very specific way, geared for people they really do think of as friends, and others it's more people who know other people or professional connections of one kind or another. But I always value Facebook, especially in those moments, not only for the sense of solidarity that a whole lot of us might feel around a particular concern, but then it's also a forum by which, especially if you have a lot of Facebook friends, including plenty of people that aren't your bosom buddies, and maybe don't see the world the same way you do, it's one of the best ways to be exposed to viewpoints and perspectives other than your own. And this was an important moment for me personally in being reminded that, you know, maybe my what I think of as a wide open, expansive view of the world is maybe not as expansive as it could be or should be.
Well, don't be too self-critical. I think it's human nature. And in terms of the United States, we are a Western nation, and it's the advanced industrial nations in not just the Atlantic area, but increasingly the Pacific and Asia, and for that matter, other parts of the world, including Central Asia and Africa, are increasingly interconnected electronically.
Absolutely.
And I do think there's some benefit, to sharing, a very powerful emotional sentiment, which you directly reflected. Sharing it collectively is very worthwhile and can be extremely positive, especially for individuals who are especially troubled. Mm. Way back in the old 20th century, when I was around, for about half of it anyway, initially the tremendous revolution in communications put a lot of power in the hands of those who wanted to control things, not just the old-fashioned dictators, but corporate interests and others, and things have become a lot more democratic with a small d, with the growth of social media, and you provide a good reminder of how important it is.
Hmm. One point you made when you wrote about the events in Paris, which really had not occurred to me, was the fact that France has a long and impressive history when it comes to fighting terrorism. And I suppose it might be one reason among several major reasons why France would be the target of an attack like this. Share with our listeners a little bit about that history of France being not only a traditional ally of ours, but also, in a sense, a very effective ally and partner when it has come to combating terrorism here and around the world.
They've been very effective historically, not just at fighting terrorism, but at fighting, period. They had, historically and have, one of the great militaries of the world. They've established and maintained a very, very large colonial empire. And their friendship for the United States was crucial, absolutely crucial in our success in our own American Revolution. The fact that the French fleet was right offshore at Yorktown and ready to go, along with their tremendous financial support, not only cemented our relationship long-term, whatever our problems, but also was crucial to that, to Washington's most decisive victory of the Revolution. Mm-hmm. But it's not just terrorism. As a colonial power, they had long and very costly involvement in Algeria, which tends to be forgotten, but was a very, very enervating war through the 50s that generated a lot of attention, including in this country. Senator John F. Kennedy, still a relatively unknown politician, especially in foreign policy terms, went out of his way to criticize the efforts of the French government to repress the the revolution in Algeria. Ultimately, the revolutionaries were successful. They had a very, very long and brutal colonial war in Indochina before we were involved in Vietnam. It was the French War. They had 750,000 men, a very large percentage of them combat troops, in contrast to us, before we undertook our direct military involvement in Indochina. They have tremendous military experience. Mm.
You also mentioned that in the wake of 9/11, France was of great assistance to us.
Yes, I should have mentioned, regarding your last question, they've been out front, literally as well as politically and figuratively, in the current allied effort against ISIS, this terrible terrorist organization, and a kind of throwback to medieval forms of criminality in the Middle East. That's right, 9/11 for the first time activated the NATO alliance. NATO was set up in 1949. As an effort, very, very successful, to implement containment policy against the Soviet Union, focused on Europe, but not constitutionally limited to Europe. It was throughout the Cold War, the NATO treaty was never activated, but after 9/11, it was among the first, Article 5, one of the first the first use of Article 5, which states explicitly an attack against one NATO member will be an attack on all, was after 9/11, when among the first, acts by an ally of the U.S. was French support, especially in terms of aircraft. They were almost immediately over the skies of North America, the U.S. and Canada, two NATO allies of theirs, which facilitated greatly freeing up our long-range, highly advanced stealth aircraft for very effective strikes against al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, a very, very important ally.
Hmm. You mentioned, again, as you write about the events in Paris, that one effect, which I would assume the perpetrators of such horrific terrorism do not intend to occur, is that it tends to actually solidify some of these really important, crucial international organizations like NATO.
Yeah. Explain
some of the more important ways in which that is proving to be true.
Well, in the case of ISIS and related terrorist groups of various kinds, existing alliances and organizations, including the European Union, have been energized from before NATO was established in 49. The very important effort at European economic cooperation has had security initiatives, security ideas. A perennial theme has been among the European members of the European Union and predecessor organizations to develop a security dimension. I don't believe that has really worked effectively at all, for understandable reasons, until fairly recently. And now the EU is, in fact, developing a form of military and security, including regional as well as national security cooperation, that doesn't seem to be undercutting NATO, which has been remarkably durable and, from my point of view, has been extremely effective in different ways. I think that will be limited. I can't see the EU developing a major military arm, nor do I think they should over the long term. But these terrorist threats, in pure cold terms, are currently not a large-scale military threat. They're a very serious criminal threat. But it may well be that the EU, given the nature and dynamics of the organization, it's not primarily a military organization, it may well be that they'll be able to develop a security dimension that marries traditional military operations with police and intelligence operations, something that's always very, very difficult to do historically and currently when you try to use the military as a police force or vice versa. You have all kinds of problems and all kinds of counterproductive and even bad things result. It may well be that the EU, given the way things are evolving and spurred, importantly, by the French attacks, the EU may well be able to bridge this gulf.
Hmm. You mentioned in one of your columns that that we can point to three European leaders that in particular have been very strong figures in this fight against terrorism, the president of France and the prime minister of Britain and the chancellor of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just speak briefly about the example that they are setting or the ways in which they are sort of leading this cause?
Yeah, you're referring to a recent op-ed that is available on the internet, and also I have a blog which Carthage College is kind enough to support that has these various columns in different complementary ways. I think Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany, whom I admire a lot, as a really important and durable democratic leader of that very powerful nation state. Prime Minister David Cameron in Britain and President Hollande of France, whom we've been discussing in different complementary ways. I think they've been extremely effective. There is a special relationship dating from World War II, and specifically Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, that has been remarkably durable, whoever has been in the White House, including the current incumbent, who does not have a particularly good relationship with the British compared to predecessors. Nonetheless, it is so strongly rooted that and our interests are so congruent that the special relationship has survived. When Prime Minister Cameron was in this country early this year, he directly lobbied members of Congress, both the House and the Senate, on pending trade legislation. He directly got in touch with these members of Congress. It made very little news. I was interested. There was no hullabaloo. Not even the most right-wing, backwoods Republicans in the House complained about this. That shows you how special that relationship really is.
That we take it for granted to that
we
extent.
We do. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's not like another country in very important ways, although we have different interests. The British may leave the European Union. I hope they don't. But even if they do, the country provides an extremely important bridge between the U.S. and Europe, especially, contrary to what I just said, and the U.S. and the rest of the world. Angela Merkel has been able to maintain long-term coalition governments in Germany. The system is working. I think she's pursued extremely sensible economic policies at home, especially regarding the European Union, and an extremely effective collective foreign policy against Russia. Mm. It really is quite a remarkable achievement. When Nazi Germany surrendered to the Allies in early May 1945, Dwight Eisenhower, who was apparently understood everything, in hindsight, was emphatic to his associates and others, including civilian leaders, "We haven't won this war. We've destroyed the Third Reich. We won't know whether we've actually won this war for another half century, if 50 years down the road, Germany is a stable democracy, pursuing the rule of law and fair treatment and democratic politics of the sort that we support, we'll know then," "we'll know then that we've won this terrible war."
Hmm. Wow.
And she personifies that victory to me.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sierra, who is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, and he joins us, of course, once a month to offer his analysis of current events. I'm anxious for us to talk about the recent events in Chicago, but we should remain in the international stage just a little while longer. Of course, there is currently a gathering of various nations around the world, important players for the current United Nations Climate Change Summit. And I wonder if you could just say a word about the significance of this conference and the particular difficulties that are wrapped up in multiple nations around the world confronting something like climate change. Are there ways in which this is a particularly difficult path in terms of achieving cooperation or any kind of meaningful agreements that might make a difference?
Any kind of international cooperation is tough, even in war. Even in the total war of World War II, where the Allies had a tremendous interest in working together and did. Churchill was mentioned earlier. He said famously, among many famous things, that I'm paraphrasing accurately, I think. The only thing more difficult than trying to work with allies is trying to get things done without any allies at all.
Mm.
We don't, thank God, have the incentive of war. The pressures for agreement in reality are a lot greater. The incentives for politicians and diplomats to engage in broad, grandiose rhetoric are particularly great when you're dealing with complicated technical issues. I think it's great that we're inspired by Churchill and others. I think it's great that we're working together on these important but really not very pressing issues. I don't know what I can say beyond that. I'm not an expert on the technical aspects of climate change. It is important to keep in mind because the rhetoric is so heated and people have such strong views. And in this country, they tend to reflect the partisan divide between left and right, that we've only been measuring the weather for about 150 years. The Earth has been around, and people have been around, and pollution has been around for a lot longer than that. One expert who does know what he's talking about, whom I do listen to, is our colleague Kurt Piepenberg, currently chair of the Geography Department at Carthage. And when I've consulted him on the topic, he's made to me the very sensible and important point that we've generated so much pollution in the contemporary period, it's got to have an impact on our climate and on our wider physical environment. And I think that's true. It's also important for interested and serious people, by definition, that's the NPR listener, in most cases, to keep in mind that there's nothing by way of being a luxury regarding controlling pollution and trying to improve our physical environment. However, it is something that only rich countries can afford. It's something that only rich countries can afford. You need a relatively high standard of living and a fair amount of surplus capital to start devoting attention to the climate as opposed to physical human survival and getting most of the people out of physical despair and constant daily challenge. In that sense, it's encouraging that we can focus so much global attention on this important subject, but a subject that's not central to immediate survival.
Right.
I hope that's clear. I think about this a lot. The media is full of a kind of cacophonous, constant barrage of statements, including from senior political leaders, that don't necessarily add to edification. I hope it's clear.
I think one thing that is a little bit of a conundrum is when you have one major country that is sort of in place in terms of their own sort of physical plant, physical structure, and then you have another country that it still seems to be on that sort of upward swing of industrial development, a country like China,
yeah.
Although maybe that's not quite so true now as it was, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago, but I mean, when the Chinese economy was just exploding in all kinds of different ways with incredibly rapid expansion.
Yeah.
And of course, if you want to talk about a carbon footprint, it felt like, you know, they were leaving an especially deep one.
Yes, they are. Yeah, they're terrible polluters.
Right.
Absolutely.
And at a moment then where, so then, you know, it seems to me they become a really, in a sense, awkward dance partner when it comes to trying to effect some kind of agreement that we and they can feel good about and are willing to undertake. That just strikes me as an especially tricky challenge.
Yes. I think one of President Obama's positive accomplishments, and what I think will be an important part of his legacy, was the agreement reached between our government and China's government on the president's last trip to China to collaborate very, very closely in bringing down especially greenhouse gas pollution, but working more collaboratively on the environment. One of our recent visitors under the Johnson rubric, Sam and Jean Johnson of SC Johnson, were very generous in giving our college a major gift quite some years ago to bring distinguished visitors to campus. Currently, our Clausen Center is overseeing that. Jeff Ball, our Johnson visitor before the most recent one, is at Stanford University, an environmental expert.
Yeah.
He was environment editor for the Wall Street Journal for a while, which drew our attention, along with the fact that he's based at a major environment center. at Stanford. His visit last year was time to coincide with the run-up to the opening of our new science center on campus. He was very effective in class, which is what we want most of all. He was very vivid and gripping in his description of air pollution in the major cities. Beijing, Shanghai, people are wearing gas masks. You can't see very far in front of you in parts of these metropolitan areas because the pollution is so strong. China's going through what Britain, urban areas in the U.S., and developing parts of Europe went through in the 19th century. It's just a terrible physical ordeal. And they have a tremendous incentive to, they are the greatest polluter, and the trend line is still up, I believe, in China. They have a great incentive to work together, and I'm very glad that our government seized this opportunity recently.
One question I wanted to ask you about the nation of Turkey, which is that country has come up a lot in our recent conversations and with good reason.
Well, I write about them fairly often. I do think they're, whatever the bad headlines, they are an extremely important country objectively, and that will only grow in the future, I believe. And they're also basically a very strong ally of the U.S., contrary to what you read and especially hear in the media.
They are poised, I believe, for potential inclusion in the EU.
Oh, yes, that's been going on forever,
right.
Though.
Right.
Their application has been sitting around for literally many years.
Right. In one of your recent columns, you called Turkey the current G20 president.
Right.
Can you explain what that means?
I can certainly try. It gets at your very insightful emphasis on the importance of regional and international organizations. I believe the G20 dates from the end of the last century, 1999, in the wake of the Asia financial meltdown, 97-98, which was fortunately contained to the Asia region, but that's a great big region. It did not become a global crash, thank God. It's been overshadowed by the more recent global crash and serious recession. It was an effort to coordinate, especially monetary policy, central banking policy initially, I think, among major industrial nations. They meet quite regularly. They have become heavily institutionalized. I believe they're quite complementary to the other important IGOs, NGOs, intergovernmental, non-governmental organizations we've been referring to. Reflecting Turkey's tremendous economic emergence over the last 20 years. They're the president this year, which means in institutional terms, they organize a whole series of meetings. There was finally a meeting of heads of government after commercial and business ministers, foreign ministers, others got together. There's a whole series of seemingly endless discussions among public officials. They perform a very worthwhile function. The capstone occurred coincidentally at the time of the Paris attacks in last month, and it really highlighted Turkey's important security role. Getting back to the point that these economic institutions, especially in the age of international terrorism, are developing effective security dimensions. The presidency means you got to do all the work.
Right.
Means that the president, prime minister, delegates a fairly sizable sector of the bureaucracy and not just the diplomats and foreign ministry types to working on these.
You're setting the table for the partygoers.
Yeah, it's a great. The members didn't do it to be nice to the Turks. The members did it because Turkey is a real powerhouse economically.
Right.
The transformation of their economy, again, largely ignored by even serious media. A lot of the time is a huge change in international relations.
And I appreciated the observation you made about Turkey, I think you called them at one time, representing a unique marriage between traditional Muslim religious practice, cultural practice, and Western governmental institutions and social practices. I mean, there's a very intriguing melding of old and new, traditional and non-traditional, in the nation of Turkey. It stands to reason that things would sometimes be a bit tumultuous.
Yeah, that's it's not a cliche, but it's a very durable reference, shorthand reference to Turkey between East and West, between the West and the Islamic world.
Not just on the map. I mean, we look at a map and we see that, of course, but it plays out in a lot of ways.
Yeah, for geographic reasons, you're quite right. For geographic reasons, where they sit on trade routes that have been important from ancient times, where they sit in control of the Strait of Bosporus, which links is the only link between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. Even more important, I believe, with the end of the Cold War, for all kinds of geographic reasons, they straddle east and west in very practical terms. Ataturk, the great charismatic, very effective, ferocious warrior, kind of a scary guy from everything one can read, but a very effective person, committed to modernization. He carried through a revolution in the 1920s, which firmly institutionalized democratic representation, despite his autocratic nature, and respect for constitutional government. With the coming to power for the first time of a religious political power early in this century, they've now been in power for over a decade, there was fear that this democratic foundation would perhaps come to an end. That hasn't happened, and it reinforces, I believe, the point that they're an extremely important ally of ours. It's common not to see them as an ally. I was able to get an academic article published in the journal Orbis beginning of this year, finally, in their spring issue. It took me, as is often the case with academic activity, it took me years to get this published. It was turned down multiple times by other journals because it's tough to get academic material published most of the time, but also people didn't agree, knowledgeable people didn't agree with the point that Turkey is only going to become a more and more important international player. I'm glad I was able to finally get the thing published, but also I do believe recent events reinforce this point. It took me years to get it published. As time went on, I was able to add more and more evidence and finally make the piece persuasive to serious editors.
Let's leave the international stage with a word of concern about Russia and the fact that President Vladimir Putin has, in a sense, crossed what you regard as a very scary line by really intervening more directly in this terrible, bloody, ongoing conflict in Syria. And you see this as potentially quite a dangerous situation. And it's interesting. You so often are the voice of calm and rationalism and don't overreact to the headlines and so on. So when you start talking about a situation being dangerous, I really sit up and listen in a way that I wouldn't, listen to somebody else who every other sentence is about something dangerous. But, when you see something dangerous, chances are there really is something dangerous there. What is the most significant potential for real danger? What makes this situation so perilous in Syria?
Well, it's the region is literally dangerous and explosive and always has been. I'm sorry if what I wrote was alarming. That actually wasn't my intent. The only point I was trying to make in the piece I think you're referring to is that the danger of physical confrontation and physical combat is much higher when you have high-performance, high-powered military aircraft, attack aircraft that nonetheless are manned by human beings, by mostly young men. We have Russian high-performance fighter aircraft. We have U.S. high-performance aircraft. We have the French. We have the Turks. And very soon we'll have the British, all in the same rather enclosed space. The opportunity for miscalculation is tremendous.
Right. So something inadvertent could certainly more easily occur.
Yeah. I wrote in one column about a very serious nuclear confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States that occurred in 1973 during the Yom Kippur War. It was at least as serious as the Cuban Missile Crisis, in my opinion. President Nixon and Henry Kissinger quite wisely chose to try to handle it outside of the public eye. They succeeded. I think Kennedy and his advisors, given the different circumstances, were quite right after they decided on our response to handle the Cuban Missile Crisis publicly. it permitted them to maintain control, but it was a very serious confrontation. It really, for me, brought home the inherent danger, which is nothing new, of the situation in the Middle East. I also wrote, and let me emphasize that, partly to reassure you, that I think, contrary to the vast bulk of the rhetoric from others, that it's actually stabilizing for Russia to be directly involved. They are basically a source of restraint on the Assad regime, ironically. And I think in that sense, outside of the significant danger of some kind of miscalculation and unintended confrontation among the great powers, that over the longer term, I think it's stabilizing and therefore, from the point of view of our national interest, actually good that the Russians are more directly involved. I'm not defending Putin. I'm not defending Assad. They're both immoral regimes, but we spend entirely too much time nowadays emphasizing morality, which is easy to do, rather than trying to analyze, doing something that's a lot more difficult, analyze specific policies and specific reactions to specific moves by others.
Hmm. You finished this particular column where you talk about Putin and Russia's presence in Syria with this: given current developments, foreign policy should be U.S. voters' priority in evaluating our presidential candidates.
Yeah.
In other words, you see the world stage as, you know, very, in a sense, serious situation fraught with some real challenges, and you think when it comes to us choosing our next presidential candidates and ultimately our next president, that we should be thinking about their foreign policy expertise and skill at least as much and maybe more than just about any other significant consideration.
Yes. I believe that's always been the case. There is a conventional belief, a widespread belief, that foreign policy is not that important in presidential campaigns. I don't believe that's true, except during a very brief, during the Clinton spring of the 90s, when it was possible for serious candidates to generally avoid foreign policy. And a very successful, brilliant politician, Bill Clinton, was able to get away with saying what really counts is the economy. That was a very brief spring between the end of the Cold War and 9/11. I do a fair amount of public speaking for the college as part of making us more visible, and I've been using in most public lectures for quite a while now the presidential politics and foreign policy. In point of fact, it's always been important at some level, but starting in 1940, it's been very important. And finally, there's the basic reality. Whatever man or woman becomes president in early 2017, that individual will be handed nuclear control codes. Now, it's not just a matter, it's not what LBJ talked about. But there's a big button on the president's desk in the Oval Office and mashing that button.
Yeah, thank goodness.
But, yeah, others are involved. But the president is the ultimate decider, as G.W. Bush liked to say. And think clearly and carefully about, do you want this person to have our nuclear codes? We still live in a nuclear weapons world. There are other major nuclear powers besides us, including France, as well as Russia, China, Great Britain. The Russian leadership especially is in a very, very difficult situation for all the bluster and schoolyard bully qualities of Putin's public persona. There are a lot of white faces in those endless photos and video footage of ISIS. They're not mainly West Europeans. They're certainly not Americans. A lot of them are Muslim males from the former Soviet Union. He has got a hell of a problem related to basic political instability that this very violent threat represents. We don't have that problem. The Europeans, by and large, at least the West Europeans, don't have that problem. It's inherently adds to the danger of miscalculation and also armed conflict that could quickly escalate in ways we don't currently foresee.
Right.
Nixon and Kissinger were, I believe, surprised by the nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union in 73. it was quite surprising that they had nuclear-armed missiles on ships in Egyptian harbors. The Cuban Missile Crisis was a total surprise. These are not, they're not stupid people, and they get the best intelligence. The world can, by definition, surprise you constantly.
So we better have a president who's ready for that.
Yeah, that's, I don't minimize the importance of domestic conflict and difficulties, which is still the bulk of the rhetoric, especially of President Obama. But foreign policy is where the stakes for all of us are highest.
Right. Let's turn to the stage of Chicago. And, of course, Chicago is a city that means a lot to you. You have a considerable personal history there. So,
my parents were from Chicago. I worked there for a long time.
Right. So I'm sure you reacted at least in some ways to this, the same way that I did for the all the different places around the country where there have been outbreaks of violence and protests over these kind of shootings. When it happened in Chicago, that felt very, very different to me. I used to live in Chicago myself. I visit there frequently and so on. And so it was left me deeply shaken, actually.
Why do you suppose that is? It's not unique to Chicago.
No, not at all. But I feel like my connection to Chicago is a very personal, is all I'm saying. I was especially struck by kind of the nature of some of those protests which occurred the day after Thanksgiving in the wake of the airing of that very disturbing footage of the shooting of Laquan McDonald. The fact that those protests occurred not in outlying neighborhoods, but occurred right in the heart of the kind of commercial hub of downtown Chicago and on an important shopping day, found that really, really striking. And I wonder if it's a foretaste of things to come.
I don't minimize the importance, and it's obviously a media focus right now. It did not turn out to be a violent riot. I'm old enough to remember the urban riots when I was quite young, the urban riots in the 1960s, and the riot at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. I don't minimize the personal tragedy, not only for Mr. McDonald, but his family. And the alleged events are and should be deeply disturbing, but it hasn't really torn up the social fabric in Chicago or anywhere else, given Chicago's reputation for violence, a particularly important center of organized crime. Historically, greatly reinforced by Prohibition in the 20s and early 30s, but predating that, the fact that there was a political machine, which is associated rightly with corruption, one of many, but the Chicago machine, it doesn't exist anymore in its traditional form. It did not under the second Mayor Daley, but I think that image tends to magnify these things. But you're right to be concerned. This has gone public. The Sun-Times this morning, the Chicago Sun-Times, has a front-page editorial demanding the resignation or firing of Terry McCarthy, the current head of the Chicago Police. I myself think that would be a mistake, as I've said on your program before. He seems to me to be effective, and he certainly seems to be public-spirited. He's under such constant attack that it wouldn't be surprising if he did leave. He's had one heart attack on the job. I think the mayor and the community need someone who is reasonable, who does not simply follow the party line of either the police union or kind of more widespread right-wing interests. There was also that job was a revolving door. They had about half a dozen in a relatively short number of years before Mr. McCarthy took the job. So I do think it's misguided to, and I don't think it will solve any problems, to sacrifice him. I think that's probably the most helpful thing I can say at this point. He supports police cameras, which is very interesting and important to me. The contrary to what a lot of police department representatives and working police feel. A good friend of mine, who's now a senior faculty member at the University of Chicago, earlier on in his career as a political scientist, went on ride-alongs in Los Angeles with LAPD, a department that's relatively corruption-free and until recent years was fairly problem-free in terms of the kind of indefensible violence and brutality we're discussing. He found it really eye-opening in Watts, Los Angeles. The squad car he was in took off after a car that was going at high speed, way over the speed limit, in a very poor neighborhood one night with the lights off. And they pulled over a young African-American fellow with a young woman with him, who my friend describes as being about 12 months pregnant. And this guy was desperately trying to get her to the hospital. He had no driver's license. He had no ID. By the book, he should have been arrested. My friend described this Los Angeles police officer as using the most foul and filthy language as a way, that's the lingua franca of the ghetto. He did not arrest him. He warned him. He made sure he had his lights on, and he sent him on his way. In fact, I think they escorted him to the hospital. If the cops are wearing cameras, you got to go by the book. If the cops are wearing cameras, this officer, who performed heroically from what I can tell secondhand by hearsay, he wouldn't have been able to do what he did. He would have had to enforce the law. Right. It's important, especially for our fine NPR audience, to keep in mind that there is a downside to everything being on the public stage, including giving desperate media people who are desperate for business reasons, not life and death reasons. The Sun-Times, the Tribune owners, they're under desperate pressure, which is increasing all the time, of an economic sort, of a commercial sort, to have these kinds of headlines. So I think the combination of an increasingly tabloid media and truly brutal and horrific events is going to make the discussion even more simplistic over time.
Right.
I hope that's helpful. It's a different point of view. I do try to think and bring a perspective that's not the mainstream to your program.
Much appreciated. I appreciate all that you contribute to this program, and I'm glad that we can.
Well, it's very educational for me. Excuse me. Yeah. It's always stimulating for me. Yeah. It really is.
I'm so glad that you could join us once again. Dr. Art Sear, Director of the Claussen Center at Carthage College, we look forward to seeing you in January.
Well, thank you, Greg. I appreciate being invited back.
Very good. Good to have you here. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street.